Our time is to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument is Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians versus Gail Norton and the Ho-Chunk Nation. Ms. Brown.
Are we recording? It doesn't sound like it's working.
Just one.
Everything's on touch.
Ms. Brown?
Good morning. Your Honors, respectfully, none of the barriers that have been posed before you bar this court from jurisdiction in hearing this case, and I'll briefly summarize my reasonings. First one I'll address is standing, and the question before the court is whether paragraph 16 of the Ho-Chunk Compact and the state of Wisconsin poses an injury in fact to the Lac des Flambeaux Band. And our position is this, that this question not only requires an inquiry into the four corners of paragraph 16, but it also requires, because of the unique relationship between the Indian tribes and the federal government, a review against the backdrop of 25 U.S.C. 476 sub F, which is the Privileges and Immunities section of the Indian Reorganization Act. that provision prohibits the secretary from placing any tribe over and above other tribes in his or her action, either by policy or inaction, as what has occurred here with the Ho-Chunk Compact. paragraph 16, in and of itself, is a violation of the privileges and immunities provision.
I think a more serious problem you have than standing is the indispensability of the Ho-Chunk Nation and its contract partner, because you're trying to invalidate their contract, something in which they have a substantial interest.
Well, to clarify, we're not attempting to invalidate the entire compact. There is a severability
clause.
Well,
I know, but you're going to make it worth a lot less to the Ho-Hunk Nation and Wisconsin if they have to face your competition, right?
Well, the question is whether the Secretary's act is appropriate and compliant with
federal
question,
law. The question I'm asking is, aren't Wisconsin and the Ho-Chunk Nation indispensable parties because the judgment you're seeking would impair their contractual rights?
Their interests are not impacted because the Secretary stands in their shoes. And there is a case
I don't understand what you're saying. How can their interests not be affected if their contract is invalidated?
Because our claim turns solely on the appropriateness of the Secretary's
action. I know
what
your claim turns on, but isn't it going to affect the contract? So shouldn't people whose contract is going to be invalidated, or a significant provision of invalidated, shouldn't they be? Don't they have a right to be in the lawsuit?
Our position is that the continuing effectiveness of a compact that contains an illegal provision warrants that their interests are insignificant.
Insignificant.
I don't understand.
I mean, you're jumping over the indispensability point to the merits. But they want an opportunity to be heard on the merits.
And our position is that the four prongs of Rule 19 are satisfied because the Secretary's position, and the Secretary is in the best position to answer whether or not her action was legally compliant. And therefore, she does not need the state of Wisconsin or the Ho-Chunk Nation to defend her position with regard to approving the compact. So therefore, whether or not their interests are impacted and they're required to change their compact provisions is not the question before the court. The Secretary needs to answer, and this court needs to review whether her actions are legally compliant, first and foremost. And the prejudice to them in not being participants to this case is very minimal.
minimal because you're saying that the secretary represents their interests? Is that...
That's correct, and that's one of the prongs of Rule 19, that parties that have an interest in a case aren't necessarily indispensable if the litigants can represent and stand in their shoes. And the action of the secretary is at issue here.
How come the action, there's really no action by the secretary?
Well, the action or inaction, it still resulted in a compact that was published in the Federal Register. So we do have a paragraph 16 that is currently viewed as valid and operable. So I think that's the difference between action and inaction is not relevant here. If we define the inaction as something that's not reviewable, this renders this kind of action and this kind of decision or decision not to act basically ends up in judicial inertia, and there's no reviewability then of the agency's action. And how is a party to determine whether or not the actions are compliant with federal law? We're not seeking an action as to or encroachment on the provisions of whether or not the revenue sharing is appropriate or equitable. We're looking at the very core right out of the chute whether this case or this compact is legally compliant.
Well, Ms. Brown, it's your position, among others, I'm sure, is that the secretary has a fiduciary relationship to all tribes, right?
That's correct.
Well, with the Ho-Chunk Nation being squarely at odds with the LDF tribe, How can the secretary then carry out that responsibility? How could she do that?
That's exactly our position, and our position is that this.
No, I mean, as to why there needs to be another party to the case.
The secretary is not representing one tribe over the other in this case. The secretary is here to defend her action to approve a provision that puts one tribe above another tribe's interest. So therefore,
But in effect, one tribe will benefit and one will not in this instance, right?
That's correct.
Right. And you have a fiduciary relationship between the secretary and both those actors, both tribes.
That's correct.
How does that carried out if there's no how does one do that? I mean, isn't there an inherent tension there?
Arguably,
whether action or inaction, I mean.
Right. Arguably, there's tension, but we propose that the analysis really needs to be taken into consideration the trust responsibility in general, and not take a position that the Ho-Chunk Nation, for example, deserves benefit over the other tribe. The question goes to whether or not this was a valid exercise of a responsibility, and not whether the Ho-Chunk should be allowed preference over another tribe, but defending the action that this does not put one tribe to the detriment of another. So,
are you familiar with the Kickapoo decision of the D.C. Circuit?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
So isn't that the same as this case?
I believe that case addressed compact provisions that dealt with revenue sharing. It did not deal with whether or not
the
compact was legally...
No, but the court there is emphatic that the state and the tribe are indispensable parties.
I believe that case also held that when a tribe intervenes in a case, they actually suffer the judgment of whatever is determined. If they are not entered in the case, then I believe that case stood for the proposition that they are indispensable. They are not in the case, but they assert that they are indispensable and therefore immune from suit, the case can't go forward.
I don't know what you're saying. They said, you know, state of Kansas is indispensable party, and it seems to be the same type of agreement as we have here. What's the difference?
The difference is, again, and I'm going back to whether or not this whether or not the reviewing court has the jurisdiction to look at the legally compliant provisions, and it's not going toward the contractual particulars of the compact, but whether or not this compact is legally compliant.
Well, that's precisely the issue in Kickapoo. I mean, one tribe is trying to sue the Secretary of the Interior to get a declaration that a compact between a state and another tribe is illegal. And the court said, well, that state and that other tribe that have this contract that the plaintiff is trying to invalidate are indispensable parties. I don't see how that's different from our case.
Well, this case is different because the 476F is at issue. The trust responsibility to all tribes.
But that was the same there.
That case, Your Honor, is different, and I'm sorry I don't recall the facts, but I do recall that those facts were different here.
It's not the facts that are critical. What the court said is, if you have a party whose contract is going to be extinguished in a lawsuit, that party is an indispensable party, period.
Well, then that would place all the four prongs of Rule 19 and to throw those out the window. Those four analyses really need to be looked at. Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that the Secretary is the best person and the only agency to decide whether or not her action was legal. Does not require the state or any other party to help her in that decision. And that is one of the prongs of Rule 19 that you need to look at. And we are submitting that we have satisfied that prong. We've also satisfied the prong
decision,
of prejudice.
Right? She didn't make a decision.
I'm sorry?
She didn't make a decision.
Her inaction resulted in a decision, Your Honor. We have a paragraph 16 that's operable. And there is prejudice. There is no prejudice to the parties. The only prejudice that they would suffer is that the compact needs to be legally compliant.
What makes you think that she would be defending the contract when all she did was simply not act on it? I mean, suppose she said, well, you know, I don't care, you know, I just didn't do anything, so if you want to invalidate it, go ahead. That would hardly be adequate representation for Wisconsin or the Ho-Chunk Nation.
She has a fiduciary responsibility to base her action or inaction on...
No, but you think her... And this is picking up on Chief Judge Flom's question. You think that, you know, the fiduciary obligation runs both ways. Suppose she says, well, I agree with you. I should have done something, so I'm not going to defend my inaction. Then Ho-Chunk and Wisconsin would have no defense. Their rights would be extinguished in a litigation to which they weren't parties because the parties weren't interested in their
The only rights that are extinguished, Your Honor, are the rights to have an invalid provision operable. And the Secretary is not representing Ho-Chunk. The Secretary is actually representing
That's
her
the
action.
Problem, right? Who's representing Ho-Chunk?
And we submit Ho-Chunk's interests are identical to the Secretary. Well, Ho-Chunk's interest and the state of Wisconsin's interests are identical
in defending...
Well, you just said
she's not defending Ho-Chunk, so she's not representing Ho-Chunk.
Let me clarify. She's not defending the position that Ho-Chunk requires preference over the other tribes. That's not what she's defending. She's defending the position that her action or inaction resulted in a valid compact. And it's actually in the reverse, so that she's not submitting or representing one tribe over the other. She's representing that it did not. And so, therefore, those interests are identical to the state of Wisconsin.
All she has to do is point to the statute and say, there's absolutely nothing in the statute that tells me that I have to approve or disapprove any of these things.
She still has to act within her fiduciary responsibility, Your Honor.
Where is that? If you look at the provision that actually governs her action on these compacts, there are no substantive standards.
There. Yes, there is substantive standards in the fact that her endorsement, however she does it, needs to be compliant with federal law, not only IGRA, but
actually,
federal law.
Actually, it doesn't say that. It says she may disapprove a compact because it's unlawful. It doesn't say she has to.
That doesn't allow the secretary to approve a compact that's illegal.
But it says she may disapprove it if it's illegal. It doesn't say she has to disapprove it if it's illegal. She can ignore the whole thing. That's the inaction, right? She just refused to take any action.
That's correct, but her inaction still needs to be within the confines of her trust responsibility, Your Honor.
But the statute doesn't say that.
It does not need to say that because the trust responsibility is inherent in all the 25 USC cases and code. Her duties are delegated by legislation to exercise a fiduciary responsibility to all tribes. And it does not need to be specific, because that is a delegation by Congress that's very, very specific, especially in the legislative history of 476F. And if I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Ms. Kovacs?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Katie Kovacs on behalf of the United States. I'd like to briefly discuss the two issues that we raised in our brief, and Mr. Marston will discuss indispensable parties. First, the district court in this case advanced several independent grounds for its dismissal. Among other things, it held, as Judge Posner just iterated, that the decision, it's hard to call it a decision, the Secretary's inaction here was committed to her discretion by law. Lac du Flambeau utterly failed to discuss that holding in either of its briefs on appeal. They've waived any objection, and the court should affirm the district court's judgment on that basis. Its analysis need extend no further in this case. But the district court's holding on that ground was correct. The delegation to the secretary here of the authority to do nothing on a compact is so complete that there's no meaningful standard by which to judge her inaction here. IGRA, as the court is aware, authorizes her to approve a compact, and it authorizes her to disapprove a compact, basically if it violates federal law. But the statute also expressly contemplates a third option. If she takes no action, the compact becomes effective. Here's an important point. It becomes effective only to the extent that it's consistent with IGRA. So if paragraph 16 is illegal, it is not in effect as a matter of law. But the point is that the statute...
But they have no remedy, would they?
Your Honor, there's no remedy in this case under the Administrative Procedure Act. There's no jurisdiction. That's not to say that they might not have some other way to get at this issue, even against the United States.
What other way?
Well, first of all, if they may be able to sue the governor, the state of Wisconsin, in state court. Certainly, if the secretary takes some reviewable action, they would be able to sue the secretary. For example, if she were to turn down an application, take land into trust for gaming, there might be some other action through which this issue might possibly come in peripherally. But even if there's no judicial remedy, I think this is an important point. The Supreme Court in Lujan versus National Wildlife Federation, and reiterated again last session in Norton versus Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, said that if a government program is not reviewable under the Administrative Procedure Act, sometimes a plaintiff has to look to Congress for relief. And here, Lac du Flambeau can look to Congress and the president. They also can look to the governor and the state legislature for relief. And the Supreme Court has said time and time again that sometimes that's the way the cookie crumbles. But in this case, the question here is whether the court has jurisdiction under
Congress,
the APA.
I don't know. What could Congress do?
Well, Congress could, as we say, hang an ornament on a tree. As they've been known to do. There's special legislation, certainly, that could govern this.
To abrogate a contract?
I'm sorry?
To abrogate a contract?
I imagine they might have, you know, we'd certainly face...
There's a contract clause.
You know, it's worth noting on that front that page 53 of the supplemental appendix is the letter from the Ho-Chunk Nation to the secretary 2 days before the statutory deadline, in which they pointed out why the Secretary could not disapprove the compact and threatening to sue the United States for hundreds of millions of dollars. Certainly, if Congress were to try certain things, we would be facing another lawsuit. But the point is that the question here is whether there's jurisdiction under the APA. And there isn't. And the Supreme Court has told us numerous times, most recently in Norton v. Sua, that sometimes that's unfortunately the way it goes, that the courts are not always the place for relief. But here, the statute expressly contemplates this third option. She can approve, she can disapprove, or she can do nothing.
Isn't that approval?
Well, it's...
Realistically.
It's, what the statute says is that the compact is then deemed approved to the extent that it's consistent with IGRA. So, in effect, the compact is effective, but only to the extent that it's legal. And I know that sounds sort of...
What if she had approved it? Wouldn't it also have to be consistent with IGRA?
It would have to be consistent with IGRA.
I'm having trouble distinguishing between the inaction and the action.
Well, the distinction is, Your Honor, that... that the statute gives no standard for no, it gives her no criteria to govern that that inaction, and it doesn't give the court any standard to judge that inaction. And as this court held in Scalise versus Thornburg, where the statute simply authorized the Attorney General to issue regulations, if he opts not to issue regulations, there's nothing to review. There's
well,
no standard.
Why can't the Locke de Flambeau challenge ask for a declaration, ask for a judicial declaration that the compact isn't consistent with the Indian Gaming Act?
They may be able to do that, Your Honor, but they need a basis they need a waiver of sovereign immunity. And the only waiver available is the Administrative Procedure Act, and the APA simply does not apply. That's why the court lacks jurisdiction under the APA. And I want to this decision to take no action, the district court's holding on this ground,
well,
is entirely consistent.
They have to sue Norton. Why can't they sue Ho-Chunk and Wisconsin, putting aside the state sovereign immunity issue? Can't they sue them?
I'd like to leave that question to Mr. Marston, but I will point out that, of course, tribes enjoy sovereign immunity as well. The district court's decision...
So you're just concerned about a suit that names the Secretary of Interior.
Exactly. Right. I'm here to represent my client, and my client enjoys sovereign immunity as well. The waiver in the APA doesn't apply, as I said, because this is committed to agency discretion by law because there's no standard to govern this inaction. And this decision to take a decision, this inaction, it's not really a decision at all, is entirely consistent with the legislative history, with what Congress contemplated would be the Secretary's role in the compact process. Congress said that gaming compacts are supposed to balance state and tribal interests. The Secretary's role in the compacting process is very limited. The compact comes across her desk for a mere 45 days, which, as Your Honors are aware, is the blink of an eye in the Department of the Interior. Certainly not enough time to do any in-depth analysis of the complex issues in a case like this. And so the inaction is entirely consistent with what Congress contemplated would be the Secretary's role in the gaming compact process. One last note on this point is that the fiduciary, we pointed this out in our brief, the government's fiduciary duties in a situation like this are defined by the statute, as the Supreme Court said last session, again, in Navajo Nation. And one other tidbit of a point is that under the APA, the court has jurisdiction to set aside agency action. I don't think that the district court would have jurisdiction to void the compact under the APA or any part of the compact. And in this case, it's nonsensical to vacate and remand. You can't order the Secretary to approve or disapprove because, again, the statute clearly contemplates this third action, this third inaction, this third option. I'd like to touch very briefly on standing as well because I think that the Locke de Flow Band lacks standing at this juncture. Their alleged injury is not fairly traceable to the Secretary, and it's not imminent at this point in time. Assuming, and I think they've misunderstood our argument, we assume, arguendo, that they have alleged an injury in fact. Basically, it comes down to a financial injury, delay, administrative layers that financially harm the tribe. And we assume that that's an actionable injury. The problem is that that injury is speculative at best. Right now, their claim is simply premature. As this court said in the Sokogan Chippewa case, the intervener's alleged harm of increased gaming competition, the court said, was pure speculation because the secretary had not yet taken any land into trust for gaming. Well, the same thing is true here. There's any number of things that might happen to prevent them from opening a new casino that have absolutely nothing to do with paragraph 16. It's simply not time yet for their claim, and I've outlined all of those possibilities in the brief. Last note, Backe and Northeast Florida chapter are not on point here. Again, the question isn't whether they've alleged an injury in fact. Those cases hold that the inability to compete on an equal footing constitutes injury in fact. We assume that they've alleged injury in fact. What Adirond makes clear is that you still need to show that that injury in fact is imminent and is fairly traceable to the defendant's actions, which they haven't done here. Moreover, those cases obviously concern...
I've lost your thread. Now, why isn't this imminent? So, Lac des Flambeaux, they want to open their own casino off the reservation.
Right. There's a number...
Doesn't this contract block them from doing that?
Well, there's a number of steps that have to come first. First of all, the secretary needs to approve their application to take land into trust. She could deny that application for any number of reasons, and I see that my time is running.
Lac des Flambeaux.
Yeah, the secretary could deny...
But I don't understand. How would they ever establish standing, in your view?
Well, if the secretary were to approve their application, they'd have a better case.
How can they apply if this compact is... This compact is in their way.
Well, they have applied, Your Honor. There's several preliminary steps before the compact even comes into play, potentially. First, they apply.
But what's the point of applying if the compact is, whether it's the first step or the tenth step, is an absolute bar?
Well, but it's not necessarily an absolute bar, Your Honor. I think that's...
Why not?
Because, for any number of reasons, the Ho-Chunk might not invoke paragraph 16.
Well, okay,
the governor,
let's put that aside.
The governor could choose to indemnify the Ho-Chunk.
Let's forget about that.
It could be that paragraph 16...
Unlikely contingencies, there are two right there.
Well, the paragraph 16 might not even come into play if there's no real competition between the new facility and the Ho-Chunk's existing facilities. But even before you get there...
Those are really bad points. You have a good point?
The good points, Your Honor, are that, as this court held in Sokogan Chippewa, until the secretary has approved an application to take land into trust, there's nothing
What's
to talk about.
What's the point to the Lac des Flambeaux of applying if this compact is in the way?
They have applied, Your Honor, and the point is to ripen their claim. That's the point.
That's ridiculous. You're just making them jump through hoops.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that, as I said before, paragraph 16, if it is illegal, is not in effect. So it could be that there are no hoops, that they are simply going through the process as they must. And numerous
but
cases
no
hold...
there's no way in which the illegality of the compact can be determined.
Again, Your Honor, there are any number of ways that it might come into a case, even against the United States, as a peripheral issue. Certainly, if the secretary, for example, were to deny their application to take land into trust, saying, well, it's futile because paragraph 16 would prevent you from opening it anyway, they could challenge that decision, and the legality of paragraph 16 might very well come into that case as a peripheral issue. But any number of cases, Your Honor, have held that to challenge a permitting process, you have to apply for the permit. Riverside Bayview is my favorite takings case.
What if an agency says... there is a futility exception to exhaustion. So what if an agency says, don't bother to apply for a permit because we have a rule which says, we don't grant permits in this class of cases. So
sure.
Leave us alone.
Sure. Absolutely, there's an exception to ripeness doctrine. And I think, because ripeness and standing overlap so much, there would be a similar sort of concept in standing doctrine. But that's not the case here. And it's also another point that we made in our brief was the fairly traceable element, which is that, as I said, since paragraph 16 may not be in effect, you can't trace the alleged harm to the Secretary of the Interior. She did nothing. If they have been harmed, and we assume that their harm is actionable, then the harm is traceable to the state and the Ho-Chunk Nation, not to the Secretary of the Interior. So again, in this APA case, the court lacks jurisdiction. And I very much appreciate the court's indulgence on the time, and I'll leave the balance to Mr. Marston.
Mr. Marston?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Les Marston. I'm the attorney for the Ho-Chunk Nation. And it's our position that Judge Crabb's dismissal of the plaintiff's complaint under Rule 19 was absolutely correct. I don't think anyone disputes that we're a necessary party. We negotiated a contract in good faith with the state of Wisconsin. We're the parties to the contract, and the plaintiffs are trying to invalidate paragraph 16 of our contract. And let's make no mistake about it. If you declare paragraph 16 invalid, you start unraveling the entire compact, and probably the entire compact amendment will fail for lack of consideration. There are very few things that a state can give an Indian tribe under a gaming compact in consideration for the payment of a fee. One of those things is market protection. Paragraph 16 gives us limited market protection. You strike that down, you strike down the basis for the payment of the fee, and the whole contract begins to unravel. So we are a necessary party because our contractual rights will be impaired. I think it's also undisputed that we enjoy sovereign immunity from suit. We cannot be sued without our consent.
Couldn't
likewise,
they bring an ex parte Young action against the state officials and the tribal officials in order to enjoin them from enforcing an illegal contract?
Well, but they would have to, our position would be they would have to bring that action not in federal court but in tribal court. They need to exhaust the tribal court remedies.
No, but in ex parte Young case, you can bring a federal court action against an individual official, including a state official, as long as you're just asking for injunctive relief.
But that would not give the federal court jurisdiction to hear this case. If they want to sue the Ho-Chunk Nation, then they can pursue that forum, and that forum would be a tribal court forum, not a federal court forum. That would be our position. So
I'm just curious. Are there any ex parte Young cases involving Indian tribes? Because, as you say, they can sue the governor of Wisconsin, saying that he is violating their federal rights and should be enjoined from enforcing the contract.
Well, there are a number of cases that have held that you can sue tribal officials under an ex parte Young theory. But if the relief that you're seeking is actually relief against the government, an ex parte Young theory will not lie. It's not a waiver of the nation's sovereign immunity from suit. But that issue is not before the...
But if your compact violates the Indian Gaming Regulation Act, then this type of suit, I agree they haven't brought it, but I'm just wondering if there are other remedies. So couldn't they ask for an injunction against the tribal officials saying you can't enforce your compact because it violates federal law?
But that's not what they did in this case. In this case, they sued the secretary. The secretary didn't negotiate our contract.
You've never been a defendant. I mean,
We have never been. We intervened in the action
just
for the limited purpose of asserting our sovereign immunity on the grounds that we're a necessary and indispensable
party.
Right.
So you were never named.
So that issue is not before the court now, Your Honor. We are an indispensable party. When you look at the four factors that the courts should apply under Rule 19, the first factor, prejudice, I think we've demonstrated that. We will suffer prejudice because our contractual rights will be impaired. Shaping relief, there's nothing Judge Crabb could have done to modify the judgment, to afford them the relief that they wanted and still not impair our contract rights. Whether the judgment would be adequate in our absence, I don't think it would be. Even if the court awarded them all the relief that they wanted, we're not parties to the case. We're not bound by principles of collateral estoppel or res judicata. We could turn right around and sue the secretary to prevent her from trying to invalidate our paragraph 16, or in the alternative, we could just simply ignore the judgment and comply with the provisions of paragraph 16, and then they would have to sue us. So that factor weighs in our favor. Finally, the fact that they don't have a forum, that factor weighs also in our favor, because the courts have consistently held that our right to maintain sovereign immunity and the state's right to maintain sovereign immunity under the 11th Amendment outweighs their right to pursue their claims. I'd like to address one issue that you raised. It's not before the court, because the issue before the court is jurisdiction, but the whole issue of whether or not paragraph 16 is valid. Paragraph 16 is consistent with the IGRA. This court in the Coeur d'Alene case specifically held that the governor has to concur or not concur. But the governor also has a choice. He can take no action. Their whole argument is that paragraph 16 delays the process. Well, there's no timetable under the IGRA. The governor doesn't have to take action. And in fact, the governor has a duty, I would say, on behalf of the citizens of the state, to determine whether or not the secretary's findings on whether their project is detrimental to the surrounding community. The governor has an obligation to investigate that and make that independent determination. We are the surrounding community. We pay a fee to the state. The state budgets that money. They use that money to provide essential governmental services to their citizens and funnels that money to local government. The governor has an obligation to take and assess what impacts the reduction in revenues to us, which a percentage of which is what the state's fee is predicated upon. He has an obligation to look at that and to determine whether or not that will be adverse to the surrounding community. Paragraph 16 is totally consistent with the IGRA. So they don't have a right. They're not going to suffer any harm because they have no right. They do not have a right to go out in the private marketplace, buy a piece of land, put it into trust, and engage in gaming on that land. That's just reservation shopping. They don't have that right. There's nothing in the IGRA that gives them that right. They have the right to make an application, and the governor has a right to investigate the facts, including how their project will impact us.
But can the governor actually veto such an application?
Absolutely. The IGRA vests in him unbridled discretion to either concur in the findings, to concur in the findings with conditions, to not concur, or as this court held in La Couturier, take no action at all. Judge Crabb did not abuse her discretion. She considered each of the rules.
So you're saying the Secretary of Interior couldn't allow them to use this non-reservation land for a casino if the governor didn't approve?
That is absolutely correct. The statute is clear. The governor must concur. Judge Crabb did not abuse her discretion. She considered each of the Rule 19 factors. She gave reasonable reasons to support her conclusions. She applied the correct legal standard. She did everything that she was required to do under Rule 19. She did not abuse her discretion. We believe that this court needs to affirm her decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Ms. Brown, your time had expired, but we've been generous with the other side, so you may have an additional 3 minutes.
Two points I'd like to raise, if I may. The first goes to the issue of the tribe, the Ho-Chunk Nation, and the state as indispensable parties. The secretary is the only party that needs to be before the court today. The secretary can only delegate that authority that she is congressionally authorized. The rights that the state and the Ho-Chunk claim they have are based on an illegal authorization by the secretary. She is in the best position to defend her action or inaction that her decision or lack of decision was compliant with federal law. With regard to the right that Ho-Chunk submitted that the Lac-Ta Flambeau lacks, under 2719B1A to put land in the trust, that whether you characterize that as a right or a privilege, that privilege is harmed by paragraph 16. So that places Ho-Chunk in a position higher than any other tribe in the state of Wisconsin. Yes, there are applications pending other than Lac-Ta Flambeau. This decision, lack of decision, will end up with multiple cases before this court, and whether or not it's ripe is not the question here. The harm is very imminent. The fact that this paragraph imposes this proprietary right of Ho-Chunk Nation poses an injury and acts as a deterrent, actually. And costs are at issue here. Delay is at issue, as well as the actual right in and of itself. Whether the governor has discretion, he has to consult with the Ho-Chunk Nation before he can make a decision. Is this a statutorily authorized delegation of authority? I guess that could be a question for state law as well. However, our position is this. We need to have the same and equal footing opportunity when we get before the governor as other tribes, and this paragraph 16 does not allow that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Our thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under advisement. The court will